Are you all ready to proceed? Ms. Barkley? I'm sorry, our clerk will call the second case. We need it for our recording.
The court will now call Mario Calavera Senior versus Quality Sports Auto Sales. You may please support Ms. Mary Barkley, the order for the appellant, and Ms. Kathy Kasabian Reed, the order for the appellant, and Ms. Derek George Zombek, the duly vote for the appellant.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mary Barkley, and I'm here with trial counsel Jerry Jarzombek on behalf of appellant Mario Talavera Sr., DBA Pro Collision Auto Repair. This is a interesting factual case that arose in the justice court against where the only petition that was on file was against Junior, the son of Senior, the appellant here today. And it was in the Justice Court of Wise County, and then it appealed to the Wise County Court at Law. The original damages were $3,000, and now there's a judgment for over $25,000 against Senior when the only petition in this case was against Junior, who was a minor at the time. The citation was issued to the son, the minor, DBA Pro Collision Auto Repair, and it was addressed via certified mail to the son. The green card for the alternate service by certified mail was signed by Senior. Judgment was taken at the justice court level against Senior, even though the only pleading on file was against Junior. And specifically, the pleading only named the son, the minor, identified his driver's license number, his date of birth, and stated that the son was acting on behalf of Pro Collision Auto Repair. After we ordered the record in this case, it was made clear that the justice court never forwarded to the county court at law the petition and the justice court judgment as required by the rule 506.2. And so this is a case that just does not pass procedural muster. The judgment against Talavera Sr. should be reversed because there's no pleading to support it, number one. Number two, the evidence is legally and factually insufficient because Senior never testified, was never called. The only testimony at trial was by the plaintiff's owner, Ben Cantu, who gave conclusory statements. On the first two issues, which are interrelated somewhat, that there's no petition in the file to support a judgment against Senior. Number one, Rule 506.2 states that when an appeal has been perfected from the justice court, which it was in this case because all of those steps were followed by Senior / Junior, because it was unclear here who the defendant was, the judge must immediately send to the clerk a certified copy of the original papers of the case. Here, the clerk's record from the county court at law indicates that the justice court did not do that. Now, the original petition in the justice court does appear, we admit, it does appear in the clerk's record as an attachment to a pleading filed by the plaintiff. There's no question about that, but did the justice court comply with 506.2? No, they did not. And there's authority under the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion in Advanced Imports versus Gibson and Victory versus Schneider that a dismissal of the entire action against the defendant is warranted in such a case because the justice court just did not comply with the rule.
Do those decisions say that it's a jurisdictional error, that it deprives the county court of jurisdiction altogether if the justice court does not forward the pleadings?
If those decisions are not, I don't think it's clear that that's a jurisdictional error. But on the other point of the fact that there is no pleading here to support the judgment against Senior, yes, that's jurisdictional. That's the second point in our brief.
Well, if the inclusion of Junior instead of Senior was a misnomer, how does that impact your argument?
Well, we would dispute that it's a misnomer. It's a misidentification, because all the misnomer cases deal with situations where there's like an error in the name. You know, you've got a different business entities and you sue LLC versus LLP, or you misspell a name, or you provide an improper first name or something like that, but you actually name the correct party.
But didn't they actually name the correct party by naming the DBA?
They named the son the minor DBA, right? Pro-Collision. So I would say no, because they were saying that the son was acting on behalf of the Pro-Collision, and I think it's disputed. And specifically, they provided the date of birth and driver's license number of the minor son. And so to say that there was a fair, under the cases that say, well, oh, well, you were fairly apprised of the cause of action against you, well, no, not in this case, because they named the son specifically as required under the recent changes to the rules to require driver's license numbers and date of birth.
Why would not Senior be aware of whether or not he or his son was operating as the sole proprietorship? Why would he not be? No, he's the sole proprietor that's being targeted by the lawsuit. And why should we not take a look at the record and how he acted, both in the justice court and in the court of, in the county court, as evidence that he in fact knew exactly that he had been targeted, that he had been given due process and notice because of the addition of the DBA and the allegation of the contract with the DBA? Okay. Why should we not be find that that's sufficient for due process under the circumstances?
Because there was never an amended. Well, first, I don't think there's any testimony from Senior that it was correctly against him. Of course, there's conclusory testimony from the plaintiff, but there was never an amended petition to name Senior as the proper defendant. And so was he given due process? No, I don't think he was, because the only explanation here is that father shows up to contest that the correct party in the case. But it's not clear that father was ever served with a lawsuit apprising him of claims against him.
Well, he did receive the actual citation in this case. It was identified by style and by pleading as against Junior DBA. So he knew the DBA was part of the lawsuit when he signed off on the green card, did he not?
Yes, he knew that there was a claim against his son at DBA Pro-Collision Auto Repair. Yes, then when he signed the green card as Senior. But he was never apprised of claims against him.
On the actual document filed as a DBA, does it say Mr. Talavera, Mario Alberto Talavera Sr., and does it also say Mario Alberto Talavera Jr. on the DBA paper that was filed?
On the original petition in the justice court in this case, it says Junior DBA Pro-Collision an auto repair.
Now, I understand that. That's not what I asked you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Somebody filed a application to do business as an assumed name. An assumed name application, or I don't know what the document's called, but you file a document that says, I'm going to do business as the assumed name of Pro Collision and Auto Repair. And I'm just asking, on that certificate that was filed, did it have both senior and junior?
I believe it had senior.
Only senior?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'd be happy to check the record and do a supplemental.
If it's in the record, I can find it.
There's no explanation here for why the change occurred at the Justice Court level. From originally, it was against junior. And then at the Justice Court judgment was taken against senior. And then there's actually also a notation on the Justice Court disposition sheet that it was senior and wife. And the point here is that how could senior have contested, well, in response to all the cases and the argument by appellees that senior waived the jurisdictional argument by showing up at the Justice Court, allegedly, and also by taking an appeal to the county court at law. I find it difficult to understand how senior would dispute or otherwise appeal this judgment taken against him when, at the Justice Court level, when there was no pleading to support it, when he was served with no pleading against him. And so to say that he waived by filing an appearance, I think, is not consistent with the rules of civil procedure applicable in Justice Court cases. Plaintiff actually tried to amend their petition and to name senior at the county court at law, and that was denied. And this case is like the Cortinas case that we cited in our brief at page 12 and 13, where the plaintiff named, sued, and served a parent of the party responsible for the negligence. The Dallas Court of Appeals held that was a misidentification, and that it's a parent and a son, or a parent and a child, they're two separate entities. You have to properly serve with citation the one that was responsible. And here, there's no evidence. Well, there was no amended petition.
There was an answer filed in the Justice Court, correct?
There was a handwritten notation filed in the Justice Court, and
was it filed by junior or by senior?
It's unclear in the record. It just says Mario Talavera.
Okay, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that junior ever showed up at any point in time of the proceedings.
The record is a little bit confusing on that point, because the civil disposition sheet at the Justice Court said all parties made an appearance. Well, and then it said and wife, and they added and wife to the disposition. And so it's unclear at that point. There was a hand strikeout of junior, and they inserted senior and wife. So does that mean that junior? It's very unclear, Your Honor, just to answer your question.
Well, the hypothetical I'm thinking of is if senior understood that this was a suit against the DBA and that it was brought incorrectly against his son, Junior, who was not operating as the DBA. And then he filed an answer submitting himself to the personal jurisdiction of the Justice Court in answer to a claim against him, which he understood to be a claim against him. Then is that not submitting to, I mean, it, at that point in time, it appears that personal jurisdiction was had by the Justice Court at that point in time.
If there were evidence that Talavera Sr. knew that, perhaps, but there's
well,
no.
I've got a judgment indicating that he appeared, and then I have an appeal of a judgment against him, which is which I don't see anything being qualified there in terms of an argument against lack of jurisdiction.
There was an argument in the appeal, a qualified argument, arguing against the jurisdiction of the court on Senior, and so I think that argument was perfected through the appeal.
Okay. But there's nothing in the argument that said, I've never appeared, I didn't get served, the suit's against my son. In other words, the argument you're making is purely the fact that Junior was used instead of Senior, and then some identifying information about Junior was in the pleading, okay, that's specific to Junior. But the DBA, at no point in time does it show that anything other than the DBA was being defended by Senior. And why should we not be able to credit the judgment that was entered by the trial court that, in fact, Senior was properly before them based upon the pleadings?
If I understand your question properly, I think the evidence is that the only notice Senior had was of a lawsuit against Junior acting on behalf of the business. And so we submit that that doesn't fairly apprise him of claims against Senior. And therefore, we would ask, under the authorities cited in the brief, that this court reverse and render judgment, that appellee take nothing, or in the alternative, remand to the county court at law for a new trial.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Reed?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kathy Kasabian Reed, and I represent the Appley Quality Choice Auto Sales LLC. This court should affirm the judgment of the county court because it did have jurisdiction over Mario Alberto Talavera Sr. doing business as Pro Collision and Auto Repair. The county court did have pleadings, facts, and documentation to base its judgment upon, and the evidence presented at trial in the county court was legally and factually sufficient. First, in regards to the jurisdictional issue. Yes.
Pull that microphone up.
Yes.
Where it picks up.
Is that
your voice.
Is that better?
I'm having trouble. Yeah, that's better.
Okay. In regards to the jurisdictional issue, appellants arguing that because Junior instead of Senior was on the face of the petition, this is a misidentification and the judgment can't stand. However, regardless of whether it was a misidentification or a misnomer, under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 93, Section 4, they were required to plead a defect in the parties. And because they did not do that, they didn't perfect that issue for appeal, and it shouldn't be considered. But even if this court does consider the misnomer misidentification issue, the crux of appellant's argument appears to be based on the notice issue. And considering that, we've touched on some of the procedural history already, but I'd like to go through that because I think it's telling of the notice that appellant did have in this matter.
Let me ask you something. Why did you feel the need to move for the substitution of Senior for Junior in the county court at law if, in fact, this was merely a misnomer case?
We argued misnomer in front of the county court, and the county court prior to trial signed an order stating it had jurisdiction over Senior. When we appeared at trial, ready to present the case, the record reflects that the trial counsel then tried to raise the issue again. And at that point, I said, okay, well, can we do a trial amendment just to get rid of this issue once and for all? I don't think it was necessary, but it was something that was raised. But at that point, the county court had already signed an order.
What does the reporter's record reflect that the ruling of the trial court was, the county court, was it that One, it doesn't seem to be that in denying the motion to substitute, the court was finding he did it didn't have jurisdiction. So the other alternative would be that it had fairly determined that this was a misnomer case and therefore it had already had jurisdiction. Is that a fair representation of what's in the reporter's record?
Yes, Your Honor. And he had signed an order to that effect stating that he did have, or the court had jurisdiction over Senior. So I believe it was, this has already been determined, this is set for trial, we're moving forward with the trial. I'm not entertaining any more on this issue.
Okay.
But going back to the procedural history, as stated, Senior did receive the petition and citation because he signed for it. He is the sole proprietor of Pro Collision and Auto Repair. He actually testified to that in the affidavit of inability to pay hearing in the county court, which is in the reporter's record, the supplemental reporter's record, volume 2 at pages 1032 and 39. He testified, I am the sole proprietor of Pro Collision and Auto Repair. He filed an answer, although it doesn't distinguish. I believe the record reflects that by him appearing at trial and his actions, that was his answer in the case. He did appear at trial in the justice court and was able to defend himself. In this case, between the justice court and the county court, he appeared 15 times. Three of those times he appeared in person. Once at trial in the justice court, the inability to pay hearing in the justice court, the inability to pay hearing in the county court. He even filed in the affidavit of inability to pay, stating, I can't afford to pay the bond to defend myself on appeal. Please don't make me pay these costs, which he did not have to post a bond. As stated, the county court signed an order stating it had jurisdiction over Senior. Senior himself filed 9 documents in this between the justice and county court where he styled the case Senior doing business as Pro Collision and Auto Repair. And the online case summary and docket sheet of the county court at all times reflected the case was against Senior. So for the appellant to now argue that he didn't have notice this case was against him, some courts have said that is a disingenuous argument, such as in the Brown versus Lanier case, when the defendant in that case did act and then later on appeal said, I didn't have notice, it was for me. The court said that is a disingenuous argument.
So what testimony under oath from a witness stand by any party as to the underlying facts of this case? Well, we've looked at the factual presentations in both of the briefs, and if I'm remembering correctly, having read this all last night, the defendant, Mr. Talavera Sr., did not testify.
Correct. He did not show up at all at trial in the county court.
But on the other hand, the plaintiff, LLC, represented by the person who was involved directly in the transactions with Mr. Talavera Sr., did testify.
Correct.
And did testify about giving him $3,000, about having him pick up a car, getting pictures showing it had been partially, let's say, dismantled. All of that was Mr. Talavera Sr. was there to hear and know that was being presented in court, was he?
Sr. did not show up at trial in the county court. He was not present.
But I'm talking about in justice court.
Oh, he was there in the justice court and did testify and put on evidence, which obviously is not in the record since it was not a court of record.
Yes, ma'am. Not much of a record from the justice court here.
Which, just finishing up the jurisdictional issue, and I would like to talk about the pleading issue. But determining whether this was a case of misnomer or misidentification, when determining it's a misnomer, courts look at, were the correct parties involved, who was served, did the correct party have notice, which I believe the record establishes all of that's true. And in my brief, I cited to the Dezo case out of Austin, which is analogous to the facts in this case where the incorrect party was named, but the correct party was sued, and her DBA was listed on the face of the petition. And in that case, the court held that it was sufficient notice and the judgment was not void. If you look at the cases said in an appellant's brief, the misidentifications, in all of those cases, the incorrect party was named and served. And for instance, in the InSearch case, which is a Texas Supreme Court case, that incorrect party then came forward and filed a verified pleading stating, we are the incorrect party, and then the plaintiff went and served the correct party. The other misidentification cases cited was the Diamond case out of this court, Cortinas, as mentioned by appellant, Merez and Wilkins, all of those, the incorrect party was named and served, which made it a misidentification case. That's not the facts of the case here. It's a misnomer case because the correct party was involved. Although misnamed, he was served, and he had noticed the case was intended for him. In regards to appellant's argument regarding the lack of pleadings in the clerk's record, as stated, the county court did have a copy of plaintiff's original petition on page 202 of the clerk's record, although it was attached to a different document, which I believe was actually filed by the appellant. Also, at trial, Senior's counsel in the county court admitted as Defendant's Exhibit 1 a copy of plaintiff's original petition, so we know the county court had it in two different places to rely upon it. Additionally,
was that pleading part of the exhibits with regard to the jurisdictional arguments that were made? In other words, my recollection is the county court actually took up the jurisdictional argument as a separate and distinct pretrial matter, and therefore was the pleading that was involved in the justice court, was that attached as an exhibit to that briefing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and that took place, I would say, about a month before the trial, but there was no evidence admitted at that hearing.
Okay.
It was purely just legal argument. They're relying on the Perry case and the Victory case, which are distinguishable from these cases in regards to the pleading issue. In the Perry case, there were no documents or transcripts provided from the justice court to the county court, and so the Court of Appeals said the county court did not have enough facts or documents to make a determination. And similarly, in the Victory case, the justice court only provided a docket sheet to the county court, and all that was on that docket sheet was plaintiff versus defendants et al. Didn't even list all the defendants, and the court said that's not enough to give us for the county court to make a determination in that case. Well, here we know the county court did have a copy of the petition at least twice, and the justice court provided the citation, the return, the answer, the civil case disposition sheet, where she wrote in who the parties were and who appeared, what the final judgment in the justice court was, and the amount of damages awarded, which I know it was stated it was $3,000. It was actually closer to, I believe, $9,000 in the justice court. They also included the notice of appeal and affidavit of inability to pay. So unlike the Perry and Victory cases, here there was more than enough documentation, facts, and pleadings for the county court to base its judgment upon. And even if under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 506.2, if it was error that the justice court didn't provide the whole record to the county court, it's harmless error because they had the documentation and the judgment was within the scope of the original petition. It didn't award anything that was outside the scope of what was pled. Although not addressed yet, I assume it'll be addressed on rebuttal, is the attorney's fee presentment issue. Under Rule 38.02 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, you have to present your claim at least 30 days before judgment is awarded. In Jones v. Kelly, a 1981 Texas Supreme Court case, the court said you must plead and prove presentment and that a letter showing your claim to the other party, sending a letter, is enough to prove presentment. As admitted at trial and reflected in the record.
Do you not also have to define what your claim is in terms of the amounts involved, liquidated damages, and include any attorney's fees that may have been incurred up until that point in time?
I believe you just have to present, yes, what your claim is. And at that time, 90 days before even filing suit, we presented our claim, which was the vehicle that the appellant kept and didn't repair and the $3,000. And we said if we had to file suit, we would be seeking attorney's fees. And then we filed in the original petition, we pled that we had presented the claim. We pled exactly what we were seeking in regards to damages and that we were seeking attorney's fees. And then again, in our disclosure responses, we specifically laid out, which was at least 30 days before trial, the specifics of our claim and in addition, attorney's fees. And 30 days before trial, filed an 18001 attorney's fee affidavit setting forth the basis of our attorney's fee claim. And all of that was presented at trial in this matter. And there was, so there, the evidence was legally and factually sufficient to support the that to support that appellee did present its claim to appellant within the 38.02. In addition to that, the appellant has been relying on the Gooden case, which is a 2008 Fort Worth case, for that presentment issue. But in that case, there was no evidence of any presentment. So the court held that they did not properly present their claim. Briefly, I'd like to discuss the appellant's argument that the evidence was legally and factually insufficient to support the breach of contract claim. As stated, the appellee was the only person that appeared at trial, put on evidence, not just conclusory statements, but specific facts of the that there was a contract, that the appellee performed under the contract, that the appellant breached the contract, and that the appellee was damaged, and what those specific damages were. In addition to that, he admitted into evidence was bank records showing what those damages were, photographs, the demand letter, and a financing statement showing that he did purchase the vehicle, how much he purchased it for, and when it was purchased. And therefore, the evidence was legally and factually sufficient to support the breach of contract claim, especially in light of the fact that there was no controverting evidence. And so I see my time's almost up. Unless there's any questions, I will sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, Justice Walker, Meyer, and Birdwell. I'm Jody Barzombek from here in Fort Worth, and just I want to address just a couple of things as to the jurisdiction and the sufficiency of the evidence. In Appley's brief, there's lots of talk about the court had jurisdiction because there was an attachment of a pleading to another motion, and that gives the court jurisdiction. But it does not, because if we just look as something like Texas Rule Civil Procedure 22 that says that the jurisdiction of a lawsuit is commenced, and a court has jurisdiction in the county and district courts of Texas with the filing of the petition. And that didn't ever happen in this case. The Justice Court had an obligation to get it there, but didn't. So this lawsuit really was never commenced in the county court. This court, under Rule 34.5, could well have said, where's the petition? Where are the pleadings upon which this claim is based? Now, in 1920, the Second Court of Appeals in Perry versus Greer had this kind of situation arise. And the court decided in that case that it was most proper to remand the case to the county court at law with directions to dismiss it unless there was a proper showing that the court had jurisdiction. And those facts still fit today. There was nothing that would have given the court jurisdiction. Now, Justice Birdwell, you asked a question earlier, and there was some talk about Rule 28. And I think Rule 28 applies to the extent that you have a situation where a person can be sued in their trade name or their true name. So if you apply that to this case, you could have said, if they left off Mario Talavera Jr., then they, based on the testimony in the County Court, that would have been Mario Talavera Sr. But they didn't do that. It doesn't say that you can pick one of the two or there's a disjunctive. They have Junior doing business as something that he doesn't do. And the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, the whole idea, I think, when Senator Corona introduced that bill, was to allow people to collect judgments because they didn't know who they were collecting from. We don't have a Social Security number. We don't have a driver's license. We don't even have the right guy. So let's make sure that we start getting it right from the very beginning. So when you have a date of birth of 1998 and you have a driver's license number that's not the right guy, that's not a misnomer. And Justice Walker brought that point up, and is it a misnomer or a misidentification? And I think you go back to the InSearch case or any of these other cases, even page 30 of the Appellee's brief, that says a misidentification occurs when you have two separate legal entities or people, and they actually exist, and the plaintiff mistakenly sues the wrong entity.
But the problem is there was only one party sued.
That's right.
And that was whoever was DBA as auto, I mean, the Mr. Talavero DBA Collision Auto, whatever, I'm sorry, the name, the actual title. And so there was one party sued. So isn't it just as logical to say it's whoever was the correct DBA as to say it was whoever was the correct person?
Not in this case, because if you were to substitute, like Rule 28 allows you to do, the correct name for the person, you would then have Mario Jr. doing business as Mario Sr., and that doesn't work because it's not a disjunctive. You can use one or the other, and I think that's what the purpose of Rule 28 is. If somebody would have said pro-collision and auto repair, that would have been fine, but they didn't. They used the two, and they got it wrong. But more importantly is that at the time of the trial, there was no pleading. Rule 301 says that the judgment has to be supported by the pleadings, and there was no pleading there in that file ever that commenced this lawsuit. And for that reason, without that, the court could not have had jurisdiction over the parties. The court of the county court at law's jurisdiction was never invoked because there was never a proper pleading that made its way over to.
So what authority do you have for that standpoint? Because clearly it's trial de novo. It's an appeal from the justice court to the county court. And you're saying that the appeal, the notice of appeal does not, unlike in our case, in the court of appeals, a notice of appeal invokes the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals, but you're saying that a notice of appeal from the Justice Court to the County Court does not invoke jurisdiction, that the thing that actually invokes the jurisdiction is not anything that's done by any of the parties, it's what's done by the Justice Court as to whether or not that court forwards the pleading to the County Court. What
Yes.
authority do you have for that?
Well, Perry versus Greer is the 1920 Fort Worth Court of Appeals case that addresses that, and Victory versus Schneider says the same thing, although they get to a little bit different result. The older case, Perry, says you shouldn't dismiss it, you should remand it, and allow the county court at law to determine whether or not it has jurisdiction, and if not, with the directions to dismiss. Victory versus Schneider is a little bit different. That says when there were no pleadings in that case.
Do either of those cases say that we cannot look to the activity of the parties with regard to the county court?
I don't believe those
determining,
cases.
In determining whether or not jurisdiction's been invoked and the parties understood jurisdiction and the court understood jurisdiction to be invoked.
I don't think those cases address the actions of the parties. What they address is whether or not there were any pleadings, because Victory specifically was talking about there were no pleadings in the Court of Appeals, and unless there was some evidence of jurisdiction that they could find from the pleadings, that court held that the appeal should be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pardon me. That bell was just to let you know that I was present.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you so much for your arguments here today. We appreciate them, and your case is submitted. You are free to go about your business, and we will remain on the bench for one more oral submission this morning.